Hello and welcome to the Blazers Edge podcast. I'm Blazers Edge writer Dan Morang, and as always, I'm joined by Blazers Edge managing editor Dave Deckard. And if you're looking for us, then you can find us on all of your podcast needs on iTunes, Stitcher, and pretty much anywhere else you want to find us. Dave, how you doing today?
Well, I am doing pretty well. We are well and truly into the summer now, where the speculation is starting to settle down. Although I like this summer, actually, because there's enough gray area with the Blazers that people are still talking about them nationally and, of course, locally, as we always do. So I think, actually, this is going to be one of the more fun dog day periods that we've had in years, and certainly one of the more interesting opening 2 months to the season.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And much like last season, there's a lot of questions around this team. However, last year you had questions and not a lot of optimism because you had Damian Lillard and a lot of questions. Now it's you have Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, and you've got some guys who you know you can get production out of, plus a few questions that aren't nearly as big. But for the potential growth, the questions, I think, become a little more ominous.
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, the question last summer was, are the Blazers going to suck or are the Blazers going to really suck? And it turned out the answer was neither. Go Phil Nasons with your playoff prediction. And it actually was spun way to the positive during the season, which was fantastic. I don't know that we'll see that again this season. That next jump will be harder to make. But one thing that we can definitely say is it's a lot more fun to be the Trailblazers in 2016 than it was in 2015.
Yeah.
Speaking of now, let's dive into this. One of the things that everybody is talking about is, well, you've got so many players on these rosters with decent contracts in the new salary structure, consolidation trade, what's their next move going to be? And two names keep coming up. Obviously, they are high-level, high-profile guys. That's why they keep coming up. We are not saying that it's realistic necessarily that the Blazers could get either one, but let's pretend like it is. And let's ask you, Dan, let's take Greg Monroe first. If the Blazers could make a 3-for-1 deal for Greg Monroe, and probably you're talking a couple of front court players and a prospect, would you do it? Do you think that would work for the Blazers?
Just so the basketball gods could smile and rejoin the Plumlee brothers, would be entertaining to say the least. And getting Miles and Mason back in together in Milwaukee would be entertaining. But from the Blazers' perspective, purely based on what's going on with Monroe's contract, you're giving up too much, I think, to get him because he's got that out. If he was under control for at least 2 more years, I think you start to kind of scratch your head and go, well, maybe this makes sense. Portland hasn't had a real post presence since LaMarcus left. That's not a big secret. So adding him would be nice, but the defensive end, you give up so much, you have to have somebody next to him, and he really can't, a lot like Myers, if you're asking him to play out at on the perimeter defensively, that's really a tough sell. So I don't know if there's a combination of players that you can give up that makes sense for the long term or the short term. However, if you did do this and Monroe does, only go 1 year and then and bolt, maybe Portland tries their hand at free agency again. I don't know. Everything to me points to no.
It's not going to save enough money to really make a significant stab at free agency is the problem. I mean, even if you trade, say, Aminu and Plumlee, those are both still old salary structure contracts. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to dip under the cap getting rid of them. It would be an endpoint move. It wouldn't be a transitional move. Although I will say also, it's pretty charitable for you to add Blazers haven't had a post presence since LaMarcus left. I mean,
not that extended. Long. Yeah.
Well, no, but I mean, it's not just not that long. It's like LaMarcus took a lot of his shots from 10 to 16 feet. Monroe is 80 to 90% within 10 feet. So they're a couple of different. I mean, they didn't have a Monroe guy even when LaMarcus was here, basically.
That's true. He does work deeper in the post. That's not, but I mean, just having that threat on the court to go to. Mm-hmm. Portland doesn't. I mean, if you throw the ball into Mason Plumlee right now, it doesn't going to work out real well. If you're going to throw it into Myers Leonard or Ed Davis, I mean, none of these guys really have. I mean, if you were going to rank these guys in post games, the most efficient move that any of these guys have is probably Myers' little running hook shot. And then that's something that he only goes to, you know, very, very, very rarely. So adding
within
that wrinkle would be fun.
Within 16 feet, Greg Monroe adds more to the Blazers' offense than every big player out there that they have right now.
Yeah.
I mean, he beats them all combined. So,
that
would certainly add a new wrinkle.
That part of it intrigues me, but I don't think Portland needs that much help offensively. Yeah, it would be nice come playoffs times when the game slows down to be able to throw the ball in there and control the tempo of the game if you wanted to. But defensively, he just doesn't give me enough. So I'm a no on that.
Yeah, that's the big problem. I mean, I like a guy who shoots 50%. He was 52% last year, but he's not between 0 and 3 feet all the time. He can legitimately go out to 15 feet. So he covers up that hemisphere, so to speak, in the offense. But does Portland use him that much? I mean, does Portland want to use their guards to dump the ball into him? I think he can pass a little bit. I think he hasn't been able to show that aspect of his game much because of how he was used in Detroit and who he's playing with in Milwaukee. So I think that they could run an offense through him and not have it be a black hole. But it's not their kind of offense right now. I'm not sure he would have fantastic synergy with the guards that they have. I can see pluses to it, but I don't know. It's kind of iffy. On the other hand, I'm absolutely sanguine with the idea that the Blazers cannot possibly play all the big men they have now. So it would be better to replace a couple of them that you kind of are halfway playing or get those guys out of there and make room for some other guys to play and replace that with a guy that you knew could play a lot of minutes very productively.
And that's the thing with when you're looking at these consolidation trades, does a guy like Monroe tick enough boxes? He gives you more offensive pop than anybody on the Blazers' current roster among the bigs. He's a Georgetown big, like you said. He can make plays from the high post. He's actually pretty decent there, in fact. So you can check the box that, yeah, he can cover up for some of Mason Plumlee's playmaking. He's going to be a major plus in the offensive categories, scoring-wise. He's a solid rebounder.
Offensive rebounder,
particularly.
He's great, yeah. Uh-huh.
So that covers up for some of what Ed Davis does. So, but again, I don't know if he's the guy that you want to go after. I think there's another guy we're going to talk about here who I've been vehemently against, but if you're going to do a consolidation trade, I think he may be the guy that makes more sense because he fits into a position, I think, more certainly than Greg Monroe does. Monroe's this kind of power forward, kind of center, but he doesn't really do defensively on either side what he needs to do in that position, and he doesn't give you enough offensively to really justify it.
So who would you play before we move on? Who would you play alongside Greg Monroe? Where would you play him? He's a starter, obviously. Would you start him at power forward or center? And who lines up alongside him if the Blazers were to get Monroe?
I would play him at center and keep him close to the paint. And I think you try to find if Aminu ends up moving out, I think that becomes an issue because Aminu can help out defensively. But if you're going to go out and try and I think it's easier to find a defensive minded four that can really help out on the perimeter and come down in today's NBA than it is to find a defensive-minded center that you can leave on the court for long periods of time. So if you're going to give up either offense or give up either defense, it's hard to find that guy that can be on the court for 30 minutes and play defense. I mean, look at what the Warriors did. You know, Bogut only played spot minutes. You look at, I mean, the guy out there really is still hasn't brought his comeback yet is Larry Sanders. I mean, that would be the guy that you play alongside him. If you're going to play him at power forward. But finding those guys is very, very hard to do.
And, of course, you can't get Sanders anymore because you don't have space to sign him.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so that's an issue. No, let's move on to that guy that you referenced. We wrote about him yesterday. That obviously is Kevin Love. He's on the tip of a lot of people's tongues. There's speculation that Cleveland might be willing to move him just because his production hasn't been up to snuff. I mean, to his standards, we should say he's fine. There's not that much wrong with him in terms of an average starting power forward with varied skills. But you're looking for more than that from Kevin Love, and he's not been very Love-ish. So making 20 million plus per year between 20 and 26, which suddenly looks reasonable given what happened this summer. If the Blazers can do a 3-for-1 for Kevin Love, is that a good move?
I've been against Kevin Love for as long as somebody can be against Kevin Love for. but if you're going to do a consolidation move, he probably fits the bill because of he's elite in two categories, getting buckets and getting rebounds. And it, when you're talking about a guy like Gordon Rowe, who's a solid offensive contributor and a solid rebounding contributor, that okay. But also Love is more of a four. I mean, you can say that this is his position. You can play him some at the five, but I think he fits in particularly between Lillard and McCollum. That would be a three-headed threat that really could drive a lot of teams crazy. I mean, Kevin Love offensively from the perimeter is kind of what you hope Myers Leonard can turn into, right?
Absolutely. He doesn't have Myers Leonard's defensive potential, but then again, Myers has only shown some of that. And let's cover a little bit what I did in the article yesterday. 2013, 2014, 26 points per game, 26 points per 36 minutes. I mean, this guy was amazing. And by the way, 12.5 rebounds, you know, that's incredible production.
26 and 13 is not anything to sneeze at.
Yeah, I think you'd be okay with that. I mean, that's and you look at that now. Okay, you've got Damian Lillard, who's at 25. You've got Love, who's at 25. And you've got CJ McCollum, who can score 20. That's pretty rare at any time, but in today's NBA, especially when you basically usually have eight players on the roster who all score 12, you know, that's would be an interesting wrinkle in itself.
And with Love, you're getting modern style NBA offense. The way I envision Terry Stotts using him isn't like what Cleveland has done to him. Cleveland has parked him out at the three-point line and used him like Bruce Bowen. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people around the NBA about Kevin Love in particular, and the way that they utilize him just doesn't really optimize him at all. But it's hard to argue when they just won an NBA title basically running pick and rolls with LeBron and Kyrie. So, but if you put Lillard or McCollum in a pick and roll with Kevin Love, all of a sudden, the Portland offense changes a ton.
Yeah, and the Blazers have a much more dynamic offense. I mean, that's kind of a compliment, but asterisk, the Cavaliers have LeBron James,
yeah.
And if the Blazers had LeBron James, they would be doing just what the Cavaliers did, and they would be better.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, it's not by dynamic, don't think better, but they probably could better use Kevin Love. And I think they could use him much more like Minnesota did. In fact, I think Terry Stotts, he's always been of the philosophy of what you do, you do. If it looks good to you, if that's a good shot, you take it. And the thing with Kevin Love is a lot of his shots look like good shots. A lot of those shots are out on the perimeter or in what was unorthodox space is becoming more orthodox for power forwards. But if in a Terry Stotts offense, that's totally orthodox. In fact, it's practically scripture.
Yeah, if you look at what he's done and the power forwards he's had to work with offensively, Dirk, LaMarcus, and then in this case would be Love. And all three are perimeter oriented. All three were very, very successful. So, I mean, like I said, I've been anti-Love for a very long time. But if you're going to make a consolidation trade and you're going to lock, I mean, his deal doesn't look terrible now. You get a couple more years out of it. You get more years than you get out of Monroe. The defense thing is my real worry. But
yeah, and
you get so much offensively that I think it can offset it enough.
It's going to be horrible, frankly. I mean, it's Kevin Love,
behind and Damian and CJ.
Yeah, behind not only behind, but involved in pick and rolls with. I mean, my God, just pick your dribbler and get Kevin Love's man to screen. Yeah, it's not going to be a pretty sight if Love and either of those guards end up defending a pick and roll. But again, who's going to outscore?
Yeah, and that's the question.
The thing is, too, okay, Kevin Love scored 16 points a game the last two seasons in Cleveland. We just talked about some of why. But a $20 million contract for a 16-point-per-game scorer is not entirely out of reach in this NBA. I mean, you just paid Evan Turner. You didn't pay him 20, but you paid him a bunch. You're not far away. And he scores just a little shy of that. So, look, I mean, and Love has 3-point potential. He takes, 40%+ of his shots from distance. There are a lot of things to recommend him. The thing is, do you hit a glass ceiling there is my concern. The offense will carry you through the regular season. It'll probably carry you through the beginning of the playoffs. Do you hit a ceiling at which simply offense is not enough and you can't muster enough defense to make up for that weakness? And if so, how do you resolve that?
Yeah, I mean, does it turn into the run-and-gun Phoenix Suns? Does it just turn into a team that, yeah, is exciting and explosive offensively, but defensively just gives up too much? Amari Stoudemire, I mean, him and Nash have both come out and said it, that the reason that those teams never really made it was because they lacked the lockdown and explosive potential defensively to take away possessions late in game and late in quarters.
That said, while I would claim Monroe was an end move because I don't think there are moves after that, and I don't think he provides enough variance to make moves after that possible, no matter who else you move, to make him that effective. If you had Love and you had Lillard and you had CJ McCollum, and we have talked in the past about eventually trading CJ McCollum away in order to alleviate that duplication of defensive deficiency in the backcourt. If you still have Lillard and Love on this team, and now you get a chance to trade CJ and someone else for a decent defensive center, I mean, let's say DeAndre Jordan comes up. Now you've got something, okay? I think Love on the roster opens up potential for CJ trades to be effective. Without Love, the guy you trade for CJ has to be Mr. All-Everything, and I don't think you can get that guy. But if you could trade CJ for a center and you still have Lillard and Love, I think you're good.
Yeah, and that's what we're talking about here is if we're talking about consolidation trades and we're talking about how Portland builds teams, this seems like one of the most likely paths, is if you're going to consolidate talent into a player that is in the upper echelon of players. My own personal view of Kevin Love notwithstanding, he's still viewed as a high-level commodity in the NBA. So if you're going to do that, a move like this, that makes the most sense because you're getting something of top-level value in return. And it allows you to make more moves, not necessarily laterally, but allows more flexibility between all your other pieces. Because if you do move McCollum, you end up with a guy like Love whose usage rate is probably going to go up, right?
Right, and he can handle it, and he can handle it. So let's get down to brass tacks then. Monroe, I just simply have no opinion on if the Blazers do it, if they don't do it, I don't think he moves the needle for me one way or the other. Is that how it is for you?
Yeah, Monroe, I'm a no on. It's just, I get why he's associated with Portland. It just doesn't make a sense fit-wise.
Yeah, I mean, I'll dance with him, but I'm not going to get married. So it's like one of those, why are we doing this thing?
Yeah.
Kevin Love, before free agency, I would have said, no, I don't want Kevin Love. I want Al Horford or I want Hassan Whiteside, right?
Oh, yeah.
That didn't happen. This possibility, if it is open, and given the state of the roster right now, financially, talent-wise, and depth, I think I'd do Kevin Love. I think I'd take that chance.
As much as it pains me, I think I'm going to agree with you on this one.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah,
people
I know.
Are going to yell at us. People are going to yell at us.
I know.
Well, we both said no like 3 months ago.
Yeah, no, and anybody who knows me knows that I'm not a Kevin Love fan. But
yeah,
if you're looking at building this team for the future, and I mean, what's the likelihood of Mason Plumlee coming back next year?
Well, I mean, I think actually that's kind of strong, especially if he gets minutes. Now, if they kind of platoon him with Azeeley, then I think he starts to look at his options. But I think Portland believes in Plumlee, and I think that he will – gratitude is the wrong word, but I think he's going to respect that and figure that being with a team that believes in you, who's far enough over the cap that they're going to pay you anyway because it doesn't help them save money to not pay you, I rate the chances of him coming back if things go well this year pretty high. You have a different view than that?
Yeah, I just don't – I don't see that he adds enough to justify what the new NBA probably justifies him getting paid for. Some people will say, well, Azeeley just got $7 million. I mean, we can probably get Plumlee for 8 or 9. I don't see it. I think he's going to end up making quite a bit more than that.
Yeah, because Azeeley only got that because of his knees.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
That's it. So
I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And I think there's some teams out there that see that Mason provides playmaking and mobility and the ability to put the ball on the court and get in transition, that heart hustle, all the kind of intangibles to where he could fit in nicely with a team and he gets paid rather handsomely.
Well, if that happens, then I think Ed Davis becomes more of a premium for the Blazers. I think he would be a priority because then you have some solid interior presence. I mean, he's not the bulkiest guy, the strongest guy down there, but you wouldn't be ashamed to have him down there, especially on the rebound again. And you still retain some sense of mobility, which I think would be important in a Lillard, Love, McCollum offense and really defense as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, so I think, yeah, I think that could work. I just think if the Blazers are going to want Mason, they're probably going to be able to keep Mason. In any case, let's ask this. I mean, one of the questions in yesterday's post too was, I believe the original question asker was postulating Plumlee, Aminu, and Vonleh for Love, which I don't think it gets it done. I threw in Myers Leonard instead. We know how you feel about Myers. I mean, would that still be a thumbs up if Myers was part of the cost along with Al-Farouq Aminu and Mason Plumlee?
That one's tough. you know, the old adage that for a trade to really get done, both teams kind of have to hate it. And I think that makes sense from Cleveland's perspective because they don't have to and they don't probably need to give up Kevin Love. I mean, they just won an NBA title. So for them, though, it makes sense because they get a guy that can play multiple positions in Aminu. They show that they play a ton of small ball that would allow them to have a lot of flexibility. They'd get some perimeter shooting and some size back with Leonard.
And by the way, Leonard could play the way Love plays for Cleveland. I mean,
they could park him out there.
Leonard like they're using Love. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think he's probably that far away from Love's 16 points either.
No, if you left Myers out there and let him play 28, 30 minutes a game, 14 to 16. I've often said that like peak Myers Leonard's 15 to 16 points and 7 to 8 rebounds. So,
And with the defense being distracted by LeBron James
and
too,
Kyrie. You
know. Yeah, exactly. I mean, so if I'm Myers Leonard, I've got like 12 thumbs up.
Yeah.
I just mutate some extra thumbs to say, yeah, send me there because I can make a career there easy and get a ring. And if Cleveland isn't as nice as Portland, it doesn't matter because, look, I got selfies with LeBron James.
And you know what? If they wanted to, they could play LeBron at the 3 with Tristan at the 4 and Myers at the 5. Tristan showed in the playoffs that he can play on the perimeter with a guy like Draymond Green. I mean, that was really impressive. So they could leave Myers inside to be a defensive anchor and let Tristan Thompson come over from the weak side, block shots, and rebound the heck out of the ball. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. That trade, though, is a really tough pill for me to swallow. I mean, I've always been a guy that thinks that Myers is eventually going to figure it out. But in the NBA, in order to get value, you got to give value. So that probably seems about on par.
Hurts for me in that deal, given Love is coming back, is losing Aminu.
Yep.
And I'm not as high on Chief as a lot of people are. I think he's good for what the Blazers need right now, but I don't think that translates into necessarily long term in any situation. He's going to be the right guy. So I don't have a problem giving him up in trade, but you just got Kevin Love in. You need a small forward. You need defense. You don't necessarily need more offense or three-point shooting because you've got that covered now. You need rebounding, hard-nosed, whatever. I mean, who does that better in this lineup than Chief does? And I'm okay with Plumlee going because I've got Ed Davis and I've got Azili, and I can make stuff happen at center. It's okay. Maybe I've even got Vonleh. Who knows? He might be able to provide an interesting change there at the five. But the problem is Harkless at the small forward and Evan Turner at the small forward. I like it on paper, but I think in reality that losing Chief in that situation might hurt.
Yeah, in the immediate return, I think the Blazers may regress some, to say it lightly, defensively.
If Love comes on board,
just a little bit.
That would be like saying, you know, France's territory in North America regressed slightly with the Louisiana Purchase. I mean, I would agree with that, that defense would regress.
But if we're looking at the long game, though, I think that deal ultimately makes sense. Portland's giving up some youth in Leonard, for sure, and some more controlled costs.
I think you can get that back too, by the way. And then let's move on because we've done 20 minutes on this. But it's like, but hey, Kevin Love. But look, I think you can get back defense at small forward easier than you can get a potential 20 plus point score.
A 2010 guy.
Unlimited range.
I mean, that's really what you're talking powerful. About.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
With that in mind, it's kind of advanced kind of where we're going here. And one question that seems to be on everyone's mind, both locally and nationally, is really, how far have the Blazers advanced themselves? I mean, how have they really pushed it this summer, and what does it all mean for them going forward?
Yeah, I mean, this is why people are still talking about the Blazers, because they're interested in this very question. And the example I used, and it may be in the mailbag that you see before you hear this podcast, or it may be after. If it's after, hey, lucky you, you got a preview. I view this kind of like a game of Risk. You know how when you play Risk, there's always that moment where you move all your armies out to the perimeter and they're kind of strung out and you've got like your maximum available territory, but it's a donut and you're not sure if the next turn that people are going to bust right through it and you're going to contract right again. I think the Blazers this summer basically bolstered themselves up behind the front line enough to where they're not going to cede that territory back, that they can confirm last year's rampant expansion and probably duplicate the level that they got to. They have improved, so maybe, you know, we get a few more wins. As we talked about last week, maybe they win the division. But I don't think that the talent, the armies that they added, so to speak, will allow them to make another similar advancement this season. So they've gotten more solid, but whether they've actually gotten better, I think, is up to debate.
So if we're keeping up with war analogies here, they've reinforced their position, they've dug their trenches, but now that there's the thin line in between, and getting across that line is the next step.
Yeah, because there's a big difference between pushing out in one turn and winning the game. You know, you've got to bolstering is important, because you can't just leave your armies out there. And I think, frankly, had the Blazers done absolutely nothing, I think their vulnerabilities would have caught up to them, because obviously toward the end of the season last year, teams were catching up to them. Teams were playing them in specific defined styles that was actually pretty effective and turned out really effective in the playoffs. Not everybody will be able to execute that in the regular season, but you don't want to go into an 82-game schedule with all your weaknesses hanging in the breeze for everyone to see. I think they've shored some of those up, and that's great, but they have not made the move that lets them take over the next continent, in my view. What about you?
I mean, like I said, numerous times, I think Portland made some moves that were good, singular moves. As a whole, I wasn't a total fan of it. However, I can see this team winning the division, as we said last week. I just think it's going to be a dogfight, and that's a step forward. I mean, when we're talking about, everybody's like, well, the division doesn't really matter. It does to an extent. It shows that you're playing above, at or at least above, or excuse me, above or at least at expectations for the season. You don't want to regress right now. After investing all this money in your guys that you plan on growing, if you're regressing, that shows an immediate...
It's a disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, going into the luxury tax for a team that continues to go backwards is going to be a problem. But I don't think either of us thinks that's going to happen necessarily. But, yeah, it's not.
No, I think they're going to shoot par. I mean, I think they'll probably end up between 45 and 48 wins. Yeah. And with the way that this conference and this division is, I think that's pretty acceptable. I mean, there's a lot of teams that are scattered in between that 50 and 44 wins range. I mean, there's five or six teams in there.
Yeah, it's going to look good. That's the thing. And that it's a joy. It's also a worry because, okay, 48 wins might get them the third seed for all you know, might get them the fourth seed. I don't think this will be a season where it gets them the eighth seed. So I think that if they get to that level, if they get to 48, they're going to look great. Are they great, though? I mean, that's the thing. And I suppose this comes down to a matter of expectations. Like, where do you think the Blazers should be aiming at? There's a sentiment out there that's like, seems to be, A, it's just Portland. B, only one team wins a championship. C, that hasn't been Portland for 40 years. And D, I just want to watch some decent basketball, and they're going to provide it. So what's the big deal? I don't subscribe to that. I think if you're not aiming for a title, then you're not doing what you need to do. So where do you fall in that line? Is it good enough for the Blazers to win 48 and look pretty good, get a fourth seed or so? Or do you think the Blazers need to push for a championship?
I'm a little spoiled. I'm a title or bust guy. The other teams that I root for outside of the Portland Trail Blazers, the St. Louis Cardinals, Los Angeles Kings, USC Trojans, they've got titles, oodles of them. I mean, they stack them up regularly. The one that even the Portland Timbers. I mean, everyone that I root for has got titles over the last couple of years or within the last decade. So it's really, really hard for me to change that view, to have that paradigm shift, to go, well, it's okay that they're competitive and they're playing winning basketball. No, I want that Larry O'Brien. I want it. I want it badly. As much as I love my Cardinals and as much as I love the Kings, my Blazers love may only be rivaled for my Trojans. If the Blazers won a title, it would be the biggest one for me. Even as an LA guy, I love Portland. I love this team. I mean, my whole fandom is invested in this team first.
No doubt about it. And I think that the other problem with it is if it becomes known in general that you are happy with anything less than a championship. I'm not saying you can't be happy with the season and how it went based on expectations or whatever. Should the Blazers and their fans be happy with last season? Absolutely. You're crazy if you're not happy with the season that was some people, we weren't, we were in the 30s, but some people were predicting 20s and they ended up winning 44 and going to the second round. If you're not happy with that, you're an idiot. But, I mean, to put it mildly.
You're right on point.
But if you let it be known that you are satisfied with anything less than a title, then your franchise is going to crumple. It's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy because the players will begin saying, well, that's good enough. And the locker room will know, well, we're not really pushing that hard. Mediocrity will become standard and eventually worse than mediocrity because you know what? This is these guys' career. This is their claim to fame. For 99.99% of them, they will never do anything that they or the public considers as important and as lasting as what they are doing right now. So if they're not pushing to leave their mark in the biggest way possible, they're not doing their jobs. And if you aren't pushing to build the team around them that allows them to do that, you are letting them down and you are wasting their careers. So you have got to push for a title. 48 wins is not satisfactory. It's something to be happy about sometimes.
It's a check mark along
the
way.
But it is not the goal. Exactly. And as soon as it becomes an end unto itself, as soon as you start making excuses, bless you.
Sorry about that.
As soon as you start making excuses, it's just Portland, free agents won't come here, blah, 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 then you might as well just pack it up right now.
Yeah, Zach Lowe had a piece this past week that I thought was really good. And I thought his outlook matches a lot of what I've said over the last couple months. If you're looking at Portland, do they have the potential to grow? Yes. But they also have the potential to be quite disastrous. If you know, plan A, B, and C don't work out, things could get really messy. And the way I described it was that if you're looking at a sliding scale of disaster to awesome, that Portland does not have equal parts awesome, equal parts disaster. I'd say that they're more likely to fall in the disaster category. Now, that's not saying that they would go full-blown disaster. I just think that it's easier for them to fall below expectations than it is to blow expectations out of the water, if that makes sense.
I would adjust that. I wouldn't say it's more likely. I'd say if you envision your sliding scale, there's more territory to the left,
yes,
to the disaster
that's,
side.
That's a better potential phrasing.
And there's not as much territory to the upside. However, I would say the Blazers are more likely to end up in the middle to the upside that they do have than they are to completely fall apart. It's just that the potential for them on the very high end does not read championship this year. The territory is smaller. They end up 48, 49, 50 wins if they have a smashing season, you know, so that's where that stops. But the potential territory downward is actually pretty big, but it's not very likely they'll trend that way. That said, I would also add this wrinkle, though. 40 wins for the Blazers this year would be a disaster.
I wouldn't argue that, because 40 yeah. wins probably keeps you out of the playoffs.
Not
probably. It does. I mean, I can't remember the last time a sub-500 team in the Western Conference made the playoffs. Was that probably, what, 06, 07?
I have to look up. But
the Warriors?
But not only that, you just bet the farm
on
a team. Yes, and as soon as the expectations now are higher because of the investment. So, yeah, the litmus test for disaster is a lot higher. I mean, the win total is higher. Last year, what would have been a disaster? 10 wins, 20 wins, those might have been disastrous, but people would have shrugged. This year, 40 wins is going to make people angry. So, yeah, that's an interesting thing. It's like you feel the shark behind you. You better swim. You just got those new fins. You just got the scuba gear. You need to swim because that shark is loose now.
It's time to make something happen. And that's really what it goes into, is that I think this year, last year was great. It was, you know, it was all gravy. Everything that we got out of the season compared to what expectations were was fantastic. Now expectations are, that's the bar.
Yeah, you know, as a team and as individuals. I mean, look, some of these guys are starting to make $20 million a year. And again, that's not the same as that was 3 years ago, but that's still a big chunk of change. It's no longer going to be adequate to say, all right, my defensive game kind of sucks, but look, I can score a lot of points, or okay, we came pretty close. You know what? Let's jimmy up some stats that say this has only happened twice on Thursday nights for the last 40 years. Okay,
hey,
no,
I love those
that's
stats.
Not good enough. Sorry, I always laugh. But it's wins. It's wins that are going to matter. And when you are paid in luxury tax territory, you'd better win. Let's. Speaking of wins, there is one guy who came on the roster this year, Festus Ezeli, who said, basically implied, that he came here to win titles. Now, every new free agent says that, or the ones that are smart anyway. We heard this also from, who was it? It was Aaron Aflalo,
mm-hmm.
or was it Gerald Henderson? I get him mixed up.
It was Aflalo.
Aflalo said the same thing, right? And 16 games and 3 months later, he's gone with definitely no title in hand. So Ezeli says he wants to win titles. Plumlee, you know, is the incumbent. Who do you start at center, assuming the roster remains the same as it is right now, and why? Is it Festus or is it Mason?
Okay, I wrote a feature about this last week, and I didn't answer the question kind of purposefully, just to kind of get a pulse and a feel for how the community feels at large, at which one of these guys ends up starting. In my mind, it's Plumlee's job to lose, and that's what the NBA says. But training camp is there to decide that. Now, if you're going to start Evan Turner, it makes sense to have Plumlee out there. And everybody's like, well, why does that make sense? Turner gives you the playmaking. I just think that if you're going to introduce one, you're going to introduce a new starter no matter what in this scenario. If you're going to introduce a guy like Turner, who gives you that defensive punch, so to speak, on the perimeter, that may help alleviate some of the issues and some of the penetration that Plumlee struggled with last season. But in a statistical viewpoint, Azeeley makes the sense of the guy to start no matter what. And I know that sounds a little weird, but defensively, he covers up for no matter who you put at that number three position, whether it's Crabbe, whether it's Turner, whether it's Harkless. He allows for Portland to have an anchor inside. And I'm leery of really screwing with that relationship behind Lillard and McCollum, even though it wasn't that great of a defense. There's something to be said for chemistry. So it's a weird dynamic.
So you're going Plumlee.
I'm going Plumlee.
I agree with most everything you said. I'll just be a contrarian, because here's the thing. Here's the extra added special sauce with Plumlee. It's his role in the offense, getting in the middle of the floor and making the pass, right? But the Blazers have not solved the essential problem that they faced last year with that offense, which is, who is Mason going to pass to? And Evan Turner and Al-Farouq Aminu is not that much better of an option than Al-Farouq Aminu and Noah Vonleh. And you're going to say, well, Evan Turner's a lot better offensive player than Noah Vonleh, so what, you're crazy? You are correct. I mean, he is a much better offensive player, that much better player night and day. There's no comparison. Turner is better, but he's not a catch and shoot guy, right?
No, not by any means.
That's not his offense. So unless you can get some backdoor action or something out of Mason in the high post, and the problem with that is he can't turn and shoot it, so the defense doesn't have to respect his high post game that much. So you just don't have the guy to whip the ball to who's going to sink it. So a lot of what Plumlee can do essentially goes to waste. Whereas Azeeley, yes, you don't have that ability, but you have added chops on defense. And as you say, the rebounding's there and everything else is pretty much there. As long as his legs can handle it, I think Festus as a starter would make some sense.
It does. Statistically, it makes sense. And normally I'm prone to go with that, but I think you want to work him into the system. Ultimately, I think by midseason, we probably see Festus as the starter. I think that, and we saw a lot of that this year. As the year progressed, you saw lineup changes, not just injury, but with the way the season went. And some people would argue, and even I would argue, that some of that was the Noah Vonleh experiment and how the Blazers viewed the season and how things were shaping up. But I think that same thing could hold true, that Portland could be a potent offense, but struggle defensively. And they'll take a look at and see at a guy like Azeeley and say, man, he gives us a lot defensively that we're just not getting with that starting group otherwise. The other thing is offensively, Plumlee struggles to finish inside around the rim. Azeeley is about or a little above average finishing inside. So you gain a little bit there. Neither one of these guys is going to hit anything outside of 5 feet. I mean, that's Blazers bigs for everyone not named Leonard. And I guess if you want to throw Vonleh in there as well. But
you don't get to throw Vonleh into anything yet. I'm sorry. No. Sorry,
okay,
Noah.
He's shown the ability to at least hit a shot. Where when Mason Plumlee shoots a 12 or 15 footer, it's an immediate facepalm.
There's that. But I keep having visions of the first half of the season, especially when Vonleh first got out there and he started taking 3-pointers, and then you think, oh, he can shoot 3-pointers, and then it's like, no.
And then you see that he's, 26%, and you're like, well, maybe not, Noah.
And that's after he got comfortable. And I'm like, I don't want to bag on the guy. I think he has potential, and he had some good moments, but he's not the guy you put in the offense or the defense to make things work.
No.
He's the guy you put in to try to hope he can play.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, I think the way things pan out is that Azeeley ultimately ends up being a starter, and it wouldn't surprise me that come February, Alan Crabbe ends up starting. And to me, that's the lineup that makes the most sense, is Damian, CJ, Crabbe, Aminu, Azili. Crabbe is still not a great defender. He's slightly above average. He generates steals. His long arms gets in passing lanes. I believe, if I'm remembering my synergy stats, that Crabbe actually led the team in transition or fast break points last season, which means he's getting and generating turnovers and scoring on the break. So having that added, because Damian and CJ aren't those guys where you think of how they score in bunches, you often don't. If you look at the highlight reels, it's not Damian fast break pull up transition threes like Steph Curry, or generating steals and finishing on the fast break. So having a guy like Crabbe adds that dimension, and he has the potential to be a plus defender. Now you've got two plus defenders out there in Aminu and Crabbe, and then Azili locking down the paint. You can cover up for a lot of the perimeter mistakes. Azili can clean up on the back end, and it allows for a much more fluid offense.
Interesting to see Crabbe at small forward, though, although I wonder how long it's going to take, and I think it's already starting to happen, where you know how there used to be a point guard and a shooting guard, and now the league has gone toward the trend of two smaller guards. Yeah, so I wonder how long it takes before that creeps up to small forward. But speaking of, well, actually two things. One guy we haven't talked about is Harkless, and we're talking about Aminu at power forward. We're talking about Evan Turner at small forward. At what point does Mo Harkless pop his head up and say, hey, you know, I should be getting some of these minutes, or I should be getting the starting spot? Does he have any claim? Do you see any chance of Mo sneaking into a major rotational role here?
He has a claim to. Portland's best lineups last year featured Mo Harkless and Aminu. So,
you think?
I mean, it was a plus 14.4, I think. With CJ, Dame, Aminu, Harkless, and Plumlee. So, I mean, you've got a lot of mobility. You've got two guys with plus perimeter abilities. When Harkless is knocking down shots, he's fantastic, and he gives you that back cutter that Portland was missing. You need that guy that moves without the ball, that isn't just beyond the three-point line. Lost in today's NBA is that everybody wants to shoot the three. Well, the counter to that is to cut back door on overextended defenses. And Harkless thrives and flourishes on that. That's where his bread is buttered. He's an unbelievable finisher inside. I believe at the end of the season, he was somewhere around 70% finishing inside. I mean, ridiculously good numbers. And that's a play that suits him perfectly and is a perfect counter to if Portland's knocking down their perimeter shots. However, when you look at the pecking order as far as pay scale goes, you've got Turner, you've got Crabbe, and then you've got, I mean, well, he's actually making more than Aminu now, so that, but that kind of gets skewed by the way the salary cap has gone. But he's buried behind at least those two guys in most people's eyes, right?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I don't believe that Mo Harkless is the answer. And I don't think probably he has as much upward potential as his most ardent supporters do. But I think dismissing him entirely might be a mistake, because I'm not necessarily convinced that a Turner, Aminu forward battery is going to work. And I think when it doesn't work, there's going to be opportunity for Myers Leonard. There's going to be opportunity for Mo Harkless. Ed Davis, I have a hard time seeing him getting off the bench. But, you know, some of these guys who you're just kind of forgetting about because everything's shiny and new and the names are bigger, might stand up and say, not so fast. Of course, you know, obviously we hope that Turner and Aminu work out just great and it's the next evolution of Portland's front court. But there's a substantial chance of that not happening.
It's kind of ironic that last year that Mo Harkless was the forgotten guy. You know, he traded for a protected top 55 protected second round pick. The basketball equivalent of a used ball rack, and he had to find his way to work himself into the rotation. And at the end of the season, he was kind of like the savior. And now we're going into this season again, and Mo Harkless is the forgotten man again. Like, hey guys, yeah. What about me? Remember what I did? Remember all the things that I did for you? Remember how well I played in the playoffs? And we're sitting here looking at it like he's this afterthought. I mean, he was the last guy to get signed. He's viewed as some as the third guy off the bench at that position. I mean, that's kind of strange when you put it all together.
unless you get Kevin Love on the roster. But that's where we started. Let's finish with this. As a salute to Timmy doing the Blazers Edge anniversary stuff. This is a question we've asked periodically throughout the years, and it is always a fun exercise, and it changes from incarnation to incarnation. If you could take one Trailblazer from years past and put him on the current team, which Trailblazer would you choose and why?
Sheed!
Sheed.
Oh,
seriously?
If you think about what Sheed was and what he did when he was here in Portland, he never wanted to be the guy, but was one of the most, if you talk to anybody who's been around basketball, Rasheed Wallace was one of the most talented basketball players of all time. It was always about not wanting to be that guy and not wanting to be the greatest of all time. And that was his to his detriment. But if you think about the way the modern NBA is played, what player would better fit this current lineup when you've got two ball-dominant guys in Damian and CJ than Rasheed? He could play inside. He could play outside. He could absolutely, defensively, he could cover the pick and roll. He could block shots. You wouldn't worry about him on either side of the floor. You've got a post game. You've got pick and roll. You've got pick and pop. I mean, he would literally cover up for almost all of Portland's deficiencies right out of the chute.
Yeah, young Rasheed Wallace was something to behold. I always maintain that Rasheed's entire Portland tenure was so severely colored by his last 6 or 7 months here that people have lost all perspective on him. And he was phenomenal. From the moment he got here and the entire offense changed to just lob it up somewhere near the bucket and let Rasheed dunk it as if he were Shaq Part 2. And it literally, they did that. That was his thing for his first year or two here. And then morphed into that all-around player, plays on both ends. The guy could pass. The guy was almost always in the right spot. It ended very, very poorly. At the same time, towards the end, everybody was asking Rasheed to be someone that he wasn't, and he wasn't going to stand for that.
They wanted him to be the guy. And that's look at what he did in Detroit. When he was reduced, not necessarily reduced, but when he was put in a role of being the best player on the team, but not being the focus of the team, he was phenomenal. When you've got a guy like Chauncey Billups, who is the unabashed, unquestioned leader of the team, and you've got the emotional guy that takes all the attention in Ben Wallace, Rasheed was free to be himself. And that's, to me, you look at Damian. Damian's the emotion of the team. He's the unabashed leader of the team. If he had that with the same time at peak Rasheed,
yeah, it'd be kind of scary. Well, the other thing that was unspoken is that team was falling apart around Rasheed.
Yeah.
And he wasn't helping. No. But
that's to put it mildly.
Yes. But no matter what he did, the writing was on the wall there, and that was going to crumble. And I think he can do that, that he probably perceived that even if he tried to become what everybody wanted him to become, he was not going to be able to save this. And I think he just mentally, emotionally checked out.
Just kind of burn it down.
Yeah, you guys aren't, it isn't worth it. It isn't, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen. Now, I'm not trying to excuse that. I'm just saying that
for perspective's
perception
sake,
of all of that was much worse probably than the reality. Understanding that the reality of the last year of Sheed was pretty bad, okay? But the perception of the team's potential was better among the fans, I think, than it was in Rasheed's eyes, probably. And he just wasn't able to deal with it very well when everything was falling apart and when he was seen as the guy who could turn it around, and he just wasn't going to do it. And he just threw it in everybody's faces. And,
what about you? Who's the guy that you go with?
You know what? I'm going to take the same era, actually, but I'm going to go down a position, and I'm going to take Scottie Pippen. And
okay.
I know I'm not getting peak Scottie Pippen. I don't need it, right? I'll take peak Scottie. I mean, that's great, right?
Peak Scottie would be insane.
Yeah, but even Portland originally Scottie, because keep in mind, the guy was playing with a talented backcourt, but that was a flawed roster, and he was still kind of the glue there. I understand he committed a lot of turnovers. I understand. But, see, Scottie was frustrated in a lot of ways because again, the team around him wasn't cohesive. The team around him wasn't all aimed in the same direction, right?
It was a collection of good to great players that didn't really fit together, but won despite it because of the overwhelming amount of talent.
Exactly. Now, this year's Blazers don't have that overwhelming amount of talent, but what have they got?
Cohesion.
They're all pointed in the same direction. And I think it would be basically like, you know, back then Scotty sat down to play a drum kit where every piece of the kit was in a different room. So how are you going to get a rhythm going, right? Here, he'd be sitting down to play a relatively new but very well-made Steinway. And just, I think he'd crack his knuckles and he'd go, you know what? You guys got the right momentum. Damian's got the right leadership. Let me show you how to turn all of this into gold. And I think he would support Dame most likely. I think that his game, a small forward, imagine he still had some of that defensive pop. He had the ability to pass. He had some ability to score left. He could shoot from a lot of different places, and he just knew when to step forward, which when the team was falling apart didn't look too good, but still he tried it. And he knew, more importantly, when to step back. And I think that's everything that this team would need, plus the veteran championship leadership experience. I have a hard time seeing a better fit in terms of chemistry and glue than Scotty.
See, it's kind of ironic. You kind of went the way of Blazers Edge lore in true Star Wars fashion and gave the Blazers a Yoda, where I just wanted to drop the bomb in there and Rashid and say, let the talent overwhelm.
Sure. Well, see, I gave him old Obi-Wan and you gave him new young Obi-Wan, right? So, I mean, that's, it's different sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. It kind of shows how you and I kind of view things, is that I think Damian has enough of that veteran leadership to maintain a guy and control a guy and be the face that he need to be to allow Rashid to be Rashid. Whereas you're bringing in Scotty, who allows Dame to be who he needs to be, but also helps all the other guys as well.
Well, and what does this team need right now? I mean, I think they've got enough gas in the car. The car can go fast enough. I think they need a roadmap, and I think they need a foot on the accelerator.
That makes sense.
I think Scotty would accelerate that growth pattern, and I think he would be able to point him in the direction. I think, frankly, Damian's graduating college right now in terms of his NBA education, and he's gone pretty fast. I mean, when he came in, it was high school time. It was like, can you score points? Can you play in this league? And he answered that. He was like, yeah, valedictorian. The last couple years have been like, well, I'm getting a degree here. And
now what do I do with
he's
it?
Done well in that too, right? But Scotty would allow him to operate on a doctoral level.
Yeah.
It would be, 2 years with Scotty, and Damian would be like, I am a leader in my field. I am, you're not going to be able to find a better, well-rounded, locker room leader than I am. But without that, you still have the issue of almost the whole team being on the same level, age-wise, experience-wise, and all of that. And it's just like the spirit is willing, but the Google Maps isn't quite there yet. They'll find it, but imagine if you could.
If you had somebody who'd been there before.
Right now, right? Not finding it in 2018, finding it in 2016 buys you a couple more years on the career and the shelf life of this team.
I almost wonder if that wasn't part of what made somebody like Azealia attractive, coming from a winning and championship culture.
I mean, it could be, although I don't know if
it's not a huge deal. But I'm just wondering if that, beyond obviously the cost of his salary and covering up holes defensively, that bringing in some of that mentality. And it's not like he's wise beyond his years or anything like that, and he's got a ton of veteran savvy. But just having you can see when guys come from losing cultures in the NBA and guys that come from winning cultures in the NBA, and typically the impact that they have on teams. And I'm wondering if that's part of what made Azealia even more attractive than maybe he would have looked otherwise.
Could be. I think part of it's a $7 million contract.
Well, but, yeah, I think that's the most attractive part of it.
And frankly, I still trade Azeelee for DeMarcus Cousins in a heartbeat, and ain't nobody more screwed up than the Kings. And he's the epicenter of that. But, yeah, you know, I think the point is there. But the neat thing about Scotty was that, and people don't understand this, it's not enough to bring a guy in. You can bring in an Earl Watson or Ronnie Price and stuff like that. That's great. They can do something. That's the kind of extra coach on the bench or whatever, that's fine. But the guys who really get it done are the guys who have the experience, who have played at the highest levels and won at the highest levels and can still
do
play.
It.
Yeah, because once you stop playing, you lose a little bit of your cachet, all right? That I think people will listen to you, but production correlates in many cases to your right to speak and to your right to influence the team, because there's an automatic veto over anything you say if you're making $3 million and playing 2 minutes a game, no matter how wise you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas the veto is, that's great, but I'm making $20 million and playing 38 minutes a game, and they're paying me. So I think I'll do what I do, three-minute guy. You know, I'm not saying that the relationship is always that way. I'm saying that
the potential is there
Pippen's,
for that.
Yeah, having Pippen's experience and ability to play would give him instant eyes and ears. I mean, nobody, I think, would question it. So anyway, yeah, I'd go with Scotty. I'm sure our readers and listeners will have other suggestions, but maybe leave them in the comments, and we can evaluate some of those for next week, perhaps.
Yeah, you know what? I think I still win this discussion just because the press conferences with Rashid and the team would be that much better.
I would love to see like Olshay
scrambling. Oh God, try to handle him?
To cover what Rashid says, and just like that, there would be like a plasma ball. Like as soon as you touch the outside, they're like moving everywhere. Anyway, we'll offer this challenge to listeners. Do you like? Would you take Rashid, or would you take Scotty, or would you take someone else? We'll see which of us will win that popular vote, and we'll discuss what everybody else says next week.
All right, well, I guess on that, we'll go ahead and wrap it up. And again, for Dave Deckard, I've been Dan Warang for Blazers Edge Podcast. Again, if you want to find us on Apple iTunes, on Stitcher. And until next week, we'll see you then.